try and get started here. Okay, we want to welcome all of you. We're going to spend the next hour talking about something that I think for all of us is really has to always be our number one priority, which is the safety of our students and faculty and staff on our campuses. And I'm going to turn the time over to Commissioner Buehler to kick this off. So, Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair Simmons. And push your stand so you might I'll just talk. I'm not going to say that, but I did.
I'll do it up. Oh, there we go. All right, thanks. That's why he's the chair. So thank you, Chair. As the chair mentioned, student safety is paramount to each of our institutions, and no matter which institution, as long as they have one student, they have concerns about student safety, well-being, that includes mental health, and just a range of issues. And, of course, the Board of Regents has been very focused on this the last few years in particular. And each of our presidents are very concerned about it. It's one of the things that can keep them up at night. So what we have planned this morning is I've asked Jeff Landward, our general counsel, to talk a little bit about where we are from a policy perspective. There's also a policy action item on the agenda for the Committee of the Whole today, so we can preview that a little bit as well. Policy, setting statewide policies, of course, is one of the levers of the Board of Regents. So it's one of the ways that we can hopefully assist our institutions and our presidents in the work that they're doing. After Jeff's overview, then we'll I'll try to facilitate a discussion. We're very anxious to have open input from all of the regents as well as presidents around the table to and commissioner staff to talk together about how we can even do a better job or some areas that we may need to focus on and improving campus safety, student safety, and well-being. So with that, I'll turn to Jeff.
All right, thank you. So as the commissioner said, my goal really is to give you an overview of the sources that we use to regulate student safety on our campuses and the system itself. Where those laws and regulations come from, what they provide for us at a statewide level, and then an update of the progress that we've made in those specific areas, in particular when we're talking about your policy, the region's policy that you put in place a couple of years ago. And so we always approach student safety and campus safety from an idea that there's three pillars that support safety. We have the general physical safety of our campuses and our students. We've been in particularly focused on mental health as an aspect of student safety, mental well-being of our students, and then also in particular sexual misconduct on our campuses. And that includes things like sexual harassment, sexual assault, stalking, dating violence, things like that. And so we try to make sure that we're addressing all three of those pillars in what we do and how we approach it. So when we talk about what regulates student safety, there are several sources that we look to. First, of course, is federal law. Primarily, we deal with something called the Clery Act, probably something some of you have heard thrown around before, and also Title IX. The Clery Act is a set of federal regulations that require our campuses to gather and report statistics on crime happening on our campuses. It also requires that the campuses assess those reports and make appropriate changes or efforts to improve campus safety based on that information. Another obligation of the Clery Act is when the campus is made aware of an imminent threat of harm to the campus or people on the campus, that they issue a timely warning to all of the campus community so that they can be aware of those threats while the institution working with law enforcement works to reduce that threat. And also we have Title IX, which we've talked a lot about. Title IX governs primarily, it was initially brought in to address discrimination based on sex, gender. Over the years, that's been expanded. The idea of what discrimination is has been expanded under Title IX to include that if you are sexually harassed or you are sexually assaulted, that that is a form of sexual discrimination. And that under Title IX, our schools are obligated to immediately assess and address instances of discrimination, harassment, assault, and then to take that and make it so that the student is no longer, that their educational opportunities are no longer hindered by that sexual discrimination or assault. A lot of attention nationally has been given to this area, in particular about how we approach a student who is saying that they are a victim of sexual discrimination or sexual assault or sexual harassment, and then how the schools and what the school's obligations are to address that, including if we need to suspend or expel someone, what are the rights of the students, what are the rights of the victim, and what is the role of the schools in making that determination. It's received a lot of attention. So that's Title IX. We also have state laws and, of course, region policies and our institutional policies. So state law, we just have received recent attention during this last session, and some of the state laws that passed on student safety will be reflected now in the policies that we're presenting you today. We have a couple of policies already in place, one of which is R-262, which is the student safety policy the region's passed in 2017. And before I get into that, we also have institutional policies, and institutional policies are specific, obviously, to their campuses and are generally quite comprehensive. We see differing approaches from our schools in trying to address that. We have, for example, if you go to the U's website and you type in safeu.utah.edu, they have really a very impressive gateway to issues of student safety that is broken up in an intuitive way where students can learn what do I do or where do I get information and then how do I report. And then having that broken up is quick access to the information that they need. I was just in the bathroom, and I found this in the bathroom here. It's a nice little magnet here that says, we are here, please reach out. It has the SafeUT app. It's very good. So this is, I'll put this back. I didn't want to steal, but I just thought you should see that. So I'll head back in there. But primarily, I think for the purposes of today's discussion, I wanted to focus on the region's initiatives and policies that you have put in place to address student safety so that you can get a sense of what you have put in place, what it's supposed to do, how we're doing on those things, and then that would give you a better sense of what's next. Are there additional areas that the regions can address? Are there additional areas that the schools have identified that are working well that they can share, and that'll be part of the discussion that the commissioner will lead. But of course, if you have any questions as we go through this, I'm very happy to address those as we go. So when we passed 262, initially it was addressing only Title IX. And so when you read 262, which we'll go through it, it focuses primarily on sexual discrimination, assault, harassment, things like that. We're going to be discussing later on the proposed revisions to that policy, and those revisions come from changes that happened in state law and some additional discussions that we've had with the institutions. We also, recently, this body approved an initiative under the mental health recommendations that came through that working group, and we're going to be taking a quick look at what those are and the progress we're making there, and then talk about the responsibilities that we see from each. So 262 is broken up into two areas, board responsibilities and institutional responsibilities. So I'll quickly go through each of those and talk about those. Starting with board responsibilities. So the first thing that we see is Title IX officer coordination. All of your schools have a Title IX officer in charge of the Title IX program to receive Title IX complaints Generally, Title IX investigations come through that office and are coordinated there. Your Title IX office works closely. Sometimes it's under the Dean of Students, sometimes it's not. It really depends on how the schools have set it up. But ultimately, they're the point person for all things Title IX on the campuses and play an incredibly important role in making sure that you're in compliance with Title IX and addressing areas of concern for students that are coming forward and saying, hey, look, I'm a victim of sexual discrimination or sexual assault. It's impacting my educational opportunities. I need the school's help. This is the source for the help. And one of the things that the board is responsible for is coordination of the Title IX officers to help facilitate coordination between the schools. The idea here is that all of the schools have these officers. They're all experiencing different things. They're all seeing different things on their campuses. We should be leveraging those experiences and opportunities and bringing them together to share those best practices, to share resources, to share experiences, and where the board can help to help coordinate that on a statewide level. We do that at least annually. We bring them all together in our office for that meeting, and that's been extremely helpful. Another area is Title IX training. Now, we have partnered with UCASA, and they held an annual conference on sexual assault. We partnered with them and expanded that to include a one-day conference on Title IX. And we bring in speakers, presentations, and training for anybody on your campus who is involved in Title IX, whether it's investigators, your Title IX officers, your general counsels, and deans of students. We've partnered with them. We put that curriculum together. We help organize that. Megan Brown in our office is the one in charge of that. She's done a tremendous job in getting that off the ground and getting that going for the last 2 years. And it's been very successful. We've gotten very good feedback from people that are involved in Title IX. We hope to continue to expand that. And one of the things that we do is we take resources from our office and pay for the registration fees for several people from each campus so that they can come and have that available to them without having to find the resources to do that. So that's been a very important area of focus for us that we hope to see get better and better. Disciplinary hearing training has been something that has been interesting. One of the concerns about Title IX has been these hearings that your schools have to hold in order to determine whether or not a student has engaged in sexual discrimination or sexual assault or sexual misconduct of some kind. One of the criticisms has been that, hey, look, you're just setting up these little mini courts in your campuses, and you're essentially adjudicating crimes. What are you guys doing? How do you know you're doing it right? Are the students being protected? Are the rights being protected? These are all valid concerns. Fortunately, one of the things that you have schools that have to deal with is that you have due process rights for these students. And before you can expel them or suspend them for a significant amount of time, they have to have their due process rights, and they have to have the ability to be heard, to confront the evidence against them. That's what these hearings are. The question came up of who's doing these hearings and are they trained to do them? We thought that maybe we could come up with a curriculum or a training that would make sense that we could offer the schools. But what we're finding is most of the schools don't have a designated hearing officer or a designated hearing committee, that these are often put together on an ad hoc basis, pulled from people on the campus, and then they're brought together to hold these hearings. What's generally happening is the attorneys that work for your institutions or the Attorney General's office coming in and advising those committees as they hold the hearings. And that's kind of training on the go. And so what we've focused on is we bring your general counsels together along with the Attorney General's office, and we discuss the challenges that we're seeing in these hearings, the areas that we feel like would be helpful as these hearings are moving forward, the appropriate role for counsel in these hearings, and we found that we've made the most improvement to these hearings in that way. We have been toying with the idea of what it would be like to maybe have a designated hearing officer, not at each campus, but for a system that could travel to the campuses and run these hearings where the decision is still left to the institution itself, but you have a professional who knows how to run these hearings, how to make sure all the rights are protected, and to keep, when attorneys are participating, how to keep attorneys under control. It's very difficult to do, from what I understand. But that's something that has gotten a lot of interest from your attorneys as well as from the legislature. So maybe that'll get some traction as we move forward. Law enforcement MOUs, most of your schools already have an MOU in place or have been working on an MOU with your law enforcement. This is not your on-campus law enforcement. This is the off-campus law enforcement agencies that would generally have jurisdiction around your campus area and are oftentimes brought in sometimes to work through issues that have bled into the areas outside of your campus. Sometimes institutions have reported back that there's been some difficulty in getting outside law enforcement to engage in a memorandum of understanding of some kind to help that partnership. What this is that the board has offered where it helps, or if it helps, to help facilitate those MOUs. We can come in and partner with you in working with those outside law enforcement agencies. Identify best practices. We've found that that's happening through these ongoing meetings, whether it's with your attorneys or with your Title IX officers, with your CSAOs, that those best practices are coming through there. And then to provide additional resources and opportunities, primarily we've invested in that Title IX conference and use the resources to make sure that that's subsidized and available to all of you. So then we switch over to institution responsibilities. What are our institutions responsible for? Yes. Oh, yeah. Marlon. Probably the best suited people to discuss that would be the presidents, but I do know that all of our campuses except for, I believe, Salt Community College, who contracts with the Highway Patrol to provide their on-campus security, have their own police officers or police forces on campus. I know that they partner with off-campus law enforcement, and that was actually the subject of some legislation during the last session, but I would open it up to presidents to address that specifically.
Access to. We do feel like the area police are more likely to give tickets and arrests than what USU police would be likely to do. We would take students through student conduct hearings rather than tickets or arrests. So we like to keep that within our campus whenever possible.
Do you want to hear from all the campus presidents,
not,
or is
not
that generally?
I think just sort of representative sampling is good. What do you have here at Snow College? I'd be interested, President.
You, so what do you have at
Snow? Do you have on-campus security people?
We've had a partnership with the Ephraim City Police, and we have two full-time officers. We went to the legislature and asked for some funding for a third officer, as well as we have some of our own local funds, and so we're in the process now of hiring a third officer.
That's sufficient. I just have no idea what that world is like.
You know, interestingly, Regent Jensen, under the law and under also Regent policy, but statutorily, the Board of Regents is given the authority to approve having on-campus police forces in the first place. And so your role, you do have that particular role, and maybe that's a topic for a future discussion about how those on-campus police forces work and the benefits that we see, the challenges that it presents, and what that looks like. But that is something that is part of the Regent's role. The next one, institutional responsibilities. So one of the first things is, of course, to have comprehensive Title IX policies in place. The idea here being that as more attention has been brought onto Title IX and to the challenges that presents, that we want to make sure all of our institutions have in place Title IX policies that cover what the requirements are of the law, that are clear and available to the student body and to the campus community so that they know how your institutions address Title IX, how you can go and make a complaint, and then what that process looks like once a complaint has been lodged. And so those are all in place at all of our institutions. We work closely with all of your attorneys to make sure that happened, and we feel very good about the direction that the institutions are going there. The next one's very challenging area, but one of significant interest, and that is to develop some sort of method to communicate information among our institutions within the system about people who have been disciplined, primarily either expelled or suspended for more than 10 days. The idea being that if you have a student who has demonstrated, has been proven to have engaged in serious misconduct that could challenge the safety of the student body, and if that student transfers to another school within the system, that the school receiving that student be aware of those challenges so that they can take appropriate action to make sure that the students in their campuses are kept safe. Now, some of those schools already have a form of transcript notation. However, when we started discussing having a system transcript notation policy, we received significant resistance from the registrars. And I think part of that is that they view the transcript itself as a very singular purpose document, and that is this provides academic information about their time at the school. And so it was roundly rejected. I tried not to take it personally, but it did sting a little bit because I wrote it, and so I felt like it was unnecessarily harsh. But over time, over the last couple of years, the national conversation on this issue has changed, and national associations of registrars have now started to move the pendulum over to where they're starting to see the utility of some sort of transcript notation. And in a recent meeting with your CSAOs, we had a very good discussion about the real need within our system to do this. It's in our policy that we have to have something in place and what that needs to look like. We've talked about things like having a separate disciplinary transcript, but that also has its drawbacks, and there is some concern about that. I think we have the momentum now. We're going back to the drafting board and to put together a new potential policy. Your CSAOs were all supportive and committed to talk to the registrars about getting something in place and what that would look like. I wanted to talk a little bit later about some of the challenges that will bring up and that you'll need to consider as a board and as presidents. But moving on, conducting coordinated climate surveys. We were set to do that this last spring in 2018. Unfortunately, that got side-railed because of, well, ultimately, we're asking you to do a lot of things from the system, and it got a little complicated because we also wanted to have you address and assess mental health. And so your CSAOs decided maybe we should do that together as one survey, and that's the direction it started going. Then they decided not to. Well, that kind of closed our window. So we're back on track to start a coordinated climate survey next year, spring of 2020. All the schools will be doing the climate survey at the same time. We're all working on common questions that will be included in your survey. That'll give the board a real window into system-level climate information. Because we'll have those common questions that we can look at from institution to institution, it'll give you that kind of insight. So we're excited what that'll look like. And then train institutional staff and faculty. The schools are doing a really good job. They all have their different methods, but they're all doing tremendous work at training staff and faculty on their Title IX responsibilities. And then to coordinate and cooperate with each other, which they do. And it's great to see that that give the benefits to the schools. Yes?
Jeff, can I just interrupt for just a sec? I just wanted to underscore the transcript notation conversation. Even without transcript notation, that communication is occurring. So often it goes through our public safety officers. So I can tell you, 2 weeks ago, we were on the phone with the University of Utah telling them about a student coming their way who was problematic. And so I think our public safety officers do it, and often our dean of students do it verbally with one another and talk to each other, which is probably better than the registrar in many cases, because they're the ones that have their eyes on safety and discipline. So I just want to assure folks that communication is informally happening and has been for many years, I think.
Has risen from conduct on campus to the legal system. That is a question on the application. I think at least at the U, and in all of our peers. We're sort of late to asking that question. Yeah, sorry. I maybe just have to sit a little closer. So I think that's another place where people ideally disclose if they've had an issue. And if they don't disclose, the institution has very large amount of latitude to remove them. So.
And I think the idea here is that we just want to make sure that the communication does happen, yeah, and that things aren't slipping through the cracks, which is always the danger of having an informal process. But, yeah, I think President Huffman is exactly right. It's not that this information isn't being passed along. It's just that it's not done in a way that we know uniformly, this is how you're going to get information. This is the source where the information will come from. Something that we should discuss here is, what do you do with the information once it's here? This is particularly problematic for open enrollment institutions. And so one of the things that we wanted to put forward to the board to have a discussion on is, should we have a policy that regardless of open enrollment, if you receive information that suggests that there is a significant safety threat, that schools have the opportunity or the ability to deny admission based on that? And what would that criteria look like? Because, of course, we don't want to overstep the mission of having educational opportunities for everybody. And also, on the application, one of the questions that come up is, not only do we ask about have they had disciplinary issues in another school, but should you be asking about previous convictions of felonies? And that national conversation on ban the box, meaning the box where you mark yes or no if you've been convicted of a crime. And should that be information that the school should be asking for and acting on or not? Or does that also cause additional problems of if we don't have people who have been in the correctional system come and receive education, the recidivism rate is likely to go up? And so, you know, these are the policy things that I think would be really fun and exciting for the board and for the presidents and the schools to really start to address. And that I could write the policy, and that would also be fun for me. So mental health recommendations. I don't want to spend too much time on this because this was already before the board. I think it was the last session of the session before where you went through these. We have completed the mental health assessments at all of our schools now, and we're waiting for that data to come in, and that's going to address, help us address now in a meaningful way all of these things that we see listed as the recommendations that came from that mental health group. So, whoops. I want to quickly go over the new revisions to this policy now. And this was the result primarily of legislation that came from Senator Iwamoto on student safety. It had some requirements that the schools had to meet and the board had to meet as well. And one of those things was that the board had to ensure that the schools have safety plans in place that have certain elements within them. Now, all of your schools have safety plans in place. That's because this is required by the CLEARI Act, which I mentioned earlier. And a lot of the elements that I'm going to quickly go through are elements that are already required by the CLEARI Act to be in your safety plans. But one of the things that is a little different is that this law requires the institutions to provide those safety plans to the board and report on efforts that they're making over the last 18 months to improve student safety and efforts that they plan to make over the next 24 months to improve student safety. The idea is that this will give the board a little more insight into what's going on our campuses to address student safety and what those plans have in place so that you can see. And then we're required to report on the efforts and also the progress that our institutions are making on student safety to a couple of interim committees, Education Committee and the Law Enforcement Committee. So that'll happen on an annual basis. So here are the things that are now required elements to go into the student safety plans. And this not only addresses Title IX issues, but it bleeds over into that general physical safety pillar that we talked about earlier. So first, they have to have instructions on where an individual can locate the institution's policies and publications related to claims of sexual misconduct. And has to have the institution and community resources for a victim of sexual misconduct. It has to contain the rights of a victim of sexual misconduct, including the measures institution takes to ensure, unless otherwise provided by law, victim confidentiality throughout all the steps. It has to contain how the institution informs campus community of a crime that presents a threat to the campus community. That's that timely warning I talked about under CLEARI. It has to have the availability, locations, and methods for requesting assistance of security personnel at the institution's campuses. So, for example, in that SafeU website, there's a very prominent click on how you can request a campus guide to come and take you somewhere if it's at night or to a parking lot or something like that, an escort. So, and other campuses have similar ways that, that you can use that as a resource and that are available. So those are the kind of things that have to be in the plan. Guidance on how a student may contact law enforcement for incidents that occur off campus. So not just your campus police, but if something happens to one of your students while they're off campus, who do they call? I would presume that that guidance would probably start with 911, but then you could go from there. A description of the efforts that the institution made in the preceding 18 months and expects to make in the next 24 months. That's what I mentioned is new. That's not necessarily included in the Clery Act, and also that something that would be coming to the board. A description of coordination and communication between institution resources and organizations, including campus law enforcement. A description of the institution's coordination with law enforcement or community resources, including coordination related to student safety at off-campus locations. And lastly, how the institution requires a student organization to provide the campus safety training as required by the law. Now, this campus safety training is something new. And the idea here is that the institutions are required under the law to come up with a curriculum that addresses, in general, sexual assault awareness, issues of consent, and also bystander training. And then to take that curriculum and to make it a required element for a student group who wants to be a student-sponsored organization under the, our institutions, that part of the requirements to get that sponsorship is that they agree and will train all of the members of their student group with this curriculum to get that curriculum out to all of the students in those groups as well as whatever training that the institutions are already providing. One of the benefits is that a lot of our institutions are already down this road. For example, Utah State has developed curriculum on those three areas that they have dispatched into these student groups and are doing that already. One of the benefits of that is that, and we have already started this process, if other institutions are interested in using that as a starting point, that that is now being shared among the institutions, and then you don't have to start reinventing the wheel, which is one of the things that the legislature or the legislation encouraged, and we're already seeing that happen. So those are the changes to R-262, and unless there are questions on that that I can answer, the next thing is really next steps. What we're going to do, and I think what the commissioner will be as part of the discussion, we're going to be continuing our efforts in working meetings and working with the directors of all your mental health organizations, finalizing that transcript notation, the climate survey, and the mental health survey, establishing training for all student groups that I mentioned, and then a couple of issues that I've already brought up, and then the rest of the time I'm just going to turn over to facilitate that discussion.
Jeff?
Yes, President.
So where is the revision of 262? Because the one that's on the website is August 2017.
So it should be in the materials for the agenda today. Committee of the Whole. Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's in the Committee of the Whole. We pulled that out of any of the specific committees because it was brought up here in this meeting, and so we figured the general conversation could happen here, and then you could have the Committee of the Whole make that.
Because it's a revision to an existing policy, the date would be the last date it was revised on the bottom of the policy, but it's in the Committee of the Whole agenda.
There should be a red line with those additional...
All right. Well, thank you.
So can I just...
Oh, go ahead, President.
I haven't had a chance to look at it because I just found it. But we are required as institutions to follow Clery and Title IX.
Yes.
I can't help but think it would be better for a statement that all institutions must follow the requirements of Clery and Title IX. And then articulate if the regions are going above and beyond. Because as you know, the Clery and Title IX are changing with different administrations. And sometimes, you know, we could be caught in a rock in a hard spot if the regions are requiring something that's different than Clery and Title IX. So following it that way would allow us then to follow the federal regulations, and then whatever we could do in addition would come through the regions.
Yeah, and I understand exactly what you're saying, and normally I think that would be the approach that we were taking. In fact, we did take that approach with the way we wrote 262.
Okay.
So that if there were changes to Title VII, that they would only just be referenced, and so that you would make those changes to be in compliance. The reason why we listed these other elements in 262 that you're seeing today is not because we pulled them from federal law, but because they are now state law. And those elements are specifically listed in the legislation. We simply took the legislative language and put it in that policy as the law required. And so if there are changes to the Clery Act or to Title IX, unless there are changes also to that state law, those elements will still be required under the law for our schools to have. So that's why we made that decision. But I think, President Cock, generally you're exactly right. And there is a lot of flux in particular about Title IX, because we're going to be receiving regulations, new regulations, that could drastically change how Title IX is impacting your schools and what your responsibilities are. Of course, your attorneys and your Title IX coordinators are watching that closely. They have not been finalized and presented yet. So we're waiting to see, but we have an idea of what they may look like, and there are some big changes coming.
And then where are we to post this?
Well, these
descriptions.
These descriptions, what these are required is that these are all in your safety plans themselves. Normally, you would probably refer them as your ASRs on your campus. That's where this information would be. So you don't actually have to post these requirements. Really, what you're needing to post is the response to these requirements, and those would go in your plans.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for that overview. We've got about 15 minutes or so before we break and go to committees. Let me just open it up for discussion. I think in particular, it'd be great to hear from a couple of presidents on your experiences, any reflections. I will just remind the group that we are being live streamed, so keep that in mind with any comments that you make. Do not say things that you don't want out on the internet. But anyway, with that, let me just open it up for discussion. Yes, Regent Jones.
Can you tell me the process, since I'm not really aware of the council president's meetings, I don't attend them, but how embedded are they working together? I guess I want to know.
Yeah.
Are they sharing information with each other, and would that be a good idea to do more of that? I just would like to know the process and how they're embedded.
Thank you for that question. Not only at Council of Presidents, but we have a number of consortial groups where we work with the individuals who are responsible at the institutions. Jeff mentioned a couple of these in his presentation. So, for example, Jeff meets with the general counsels for each of the institutions on a regular basis. Liz Hitch and Greg Benson meet with the chief academic officers and the chief student affairs officers. I meet with the presidents. Kimberly and her group meets with the business Affairs Council, which is the business VPs, and so all of those areas. When it comes to items coming to the Board of Regents agenda, anything that is substantive, before I bring it to you as a recommendation, I share it with the Council of Presidents. And so they have an opportunity to review the things that are coming to you and to provide me input. Ultimately, under your policy, under state law, the commissioner makes the recommendation after receiving the input. So it's not like a legislative body where they debate. Well, they do debate, believe me. We don't vote, but I get their input and then make my recommendation. That's the same for past and future commissioners. Does that help to just kind of give a little overview
better
of the process? Yes.
But
these
maybe,
don't just
maybe
soar in.
I feel like I need more information about what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, maybe more feedback too. And I don't know if I'm alone, but I might be.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I would say,
President,
with the very tragic murder of Lauren McCluskey on our campus, we have had the difficult opportunity to very carefully examine our processes and our practices and our personnel around safety. And we have tried to be very open and very transparent about that. So on the Safety website that Jeff mentioned, the independent review that was conducted of the university identified 30 recommended actions We have been very open about the weaknesses we identified and the actions we have taken and or are taking to remedy and address that. And I think that website is open to everyone and is actually pretty useful and informative. You know, we are an urban campus. There are very useful lessons, I think, for all of us in terms of coordination and communication of information, of how we can learn from a very tragic event to try to be safer, better institutions. And that's been our commitment. We've tried to just open it up and identify all the actions, identify where we are in implementing the steps of change. And I think that's a good roadmap, really, for many other institutions to just take a look and see what's relevant for you and what you might even add to it or know about already from your own campuses.
I mean, should we be more formally trying to turn that into a checklist and asking institutions to audit against it? There's been so much good work done. I'm wondering if we shouldn't maybe as a board think about asking each institution to go through it. Obviously, there are going to be things that... on a campus like Snow that are just different than a campus like the University of Utah.
Right.
But it would be a pretty good roadmap, I would think, for us to be checking against and asking each institution to kind of thoughtfully think about what could we learn from that particular recommendation and how would that fit on in our circumstances and our campus.
Yes, I think that's a great suggestion. President Mortensen?
Yeah, and to that point, Chair Simmons, President Watkins, we were able to take your report and do that type of review on our campus and used it to help make decisions throughout our budget process this spring of where do we need to allocate resources, particularly to address some of our shortcomings that maybe could be improved through the analysis that had been done. Unfortunately, through the tragedy of the University of Utah. So we are trying to apply that principle. And I think there's that sense throughout the system on all of these difficult issues to try to learn from each other.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you. More discussion. And of course, there are differences, as Chair Simmons said, based on the type of institution. I mean, one that occurs to me is it's probably... quite different if you're dealing mostly with younger students away from home for the first time on a residential campus versus maybe returning adults in an urban area. They all have issues, but they may be different issues. It might be helpful for the board to get a sense from presidents of what some of those differences or those challenges are. Or if there's other questions or comments from the board, but President
Hoffman. I'd like to share a little. Although we have the Utah Highway Patrol contract, that's for three of our largest campuses. And then we also have campus security officers on all of our sites. So we have kind of a hybrid approach. So Utah Highway Patrol won't respond at our Sandy campus, for instance. We have to have an MOU with Sandy's police. And so we have, it's very complicated in terms of, it's very expensive. And it's, we've had in-house, we've had out-of-house, we've had hybrid. We're constantly trying to figure out how to manage that in a more of an urban environment. But some of our sites are a storefront, and some of our sites have, you know, eight buildings. So it's just, it's not like community college. It's a really tricky, I think, thing to consider in terms of the best way to manage it. We've had to, again, in response from the use event, we met with Utah Highway Patrol to talk about the threat assessment training that their officers have gone through and whether our officers have done that, especially related to relationship violence. But we've also looked at kind of an audit about patrol and how long. We have students that are on our campus all across the county till 10 o'clock at night. Do we have adequate transportation after 10? UTA stops at 9:40. What happens to students? I mean, it goes outside of safety and into mental health and veterans affairs and transportation. I mean, there's a really big web there that I think, you know, not that it's overly... It's not too complex to handle, but it's more complex than having a policy that says you should do these things, right?
And so, absolutely. Yes.
President, I was thinking about that issue of healthy and unhealthy relationships and relationship violence because that is an area that I think just in general, societally, we're not very well equipped, and that has permeated our campuses as well. Through tragic events, there are I think, groups that have developed some very strong expertise. We have found that useful. There's a national foundation called One Love. We hosted an event 2 days on campus. And with the effort of training, awareness, increasing, and this is relevant for staff, faculty, and students alike. I mean, it's helping your community see signs of unhealthy relationships and the understanding the lethality assessment protocol. So there's, in addition to us sharing information with each other, there's the access to kind of national expertise that has been helpful for us at the U and other places as well.
Thanks. President Carlston, did you?
It was said that this is one of the things that keeps presidents, certainly I think all of us, awake at night worrying about things like this. At Snow, we have added personnel. We do a lot more training. We spend a lot of time informing not only students but faculty and staff. It's a great concern for us, and I think the point that the commissioner makes about having a residential campus versus a non-residential campus is a significant point. And we work very, very closely with our residence life folks on this issue as well. Athletic programs, very important that we keep them in the loop. And our coaches have been very, very helpful in ensuring that this training and their own enforcement is taking place.
President Cockett, did you have a...
Yeah, sure. I was just going to say that one of the issues that we've come up with and are trying to handle right now is the suspension of a faculty member or student who a charge has been made against. And as more and more emphasis is being put on the rights of the accused person, we actually are in a difficult spot on how to have the time to do the necessary investigation, come up with the finding, while still keeping the campus safe. And we just recently had a grievance that was found by a grievance committee of faculty who said that a faculty member was de facto suspended against our policies as we were trying to handle a charge of discrimination against students. So I guess I would just encourage my colleagues, make sure that you're looking at the faculty code and even the student code on a way that you can temporarily help both the accused and the victim.
President Dominguez, yes.
So, hello.
Yes, you're on.
So UVU is interesting because it is, as you know, primarily a commuter campus. And I think so far, at least in my tenure, it has felt pretty much like a safe campus. Our challenges probably will change once we're done building, not we, but PEG Development is finished building the housing that's now, you know, surrounded by UVU on three sides. So we will have 1,600, is that the right number, Val, 1,600 beds. So that may change the dynamics of safety. We have on campus the BAT, the Behavioral Assessment Team, and I credit that for really much of the early warning and observation and early intervention, because I think for safety, we all know that the early intervention, it's sort of, you know, the ounce of prevention, pound of cure principle. So that group is really pretty strong. And before my time, I know that our police, campus police, right, has been strengthened as well in terms of professionalism and leadership. And then recently we had this very interesting exercise of an active shooter simulation, real shooting but blanks, you know. And we actually collaborated with the Orem Police, Provo Police, also the Intermountain Healthcare. So hospitals, everything, if you were to simulate if something really happened and you had an active shooter on campus, and then we kind of dissected the learnings from that afterwards. What's interesting is that preparation is both mental and process and physical. Mental is especially important because whatever happens, you've got to somehow stay, you know, calm and act in the way that you should. For sexual assaults, we have in our last planning budget and assessment allocated funding for victims advocate. I want my colleagues to correct me if I got that wrong. Victims advocate, because we looked at the landscape and asked ourselves, what is missing? What's the missing person in order to make this process stronger? So, I mean, anyway, we hope we stay safe as more students now move and live on campus.
Thanks for those observations. And, of course, one of the challenges is that probably most of the people around this table, the presidents and their colleagues in the room with us, didn't get into higher education because they were interested in this topic. They got into it because they wanted to teach and promote learning and all of those things. And yet we are part of this larger society, which it brings with it, and our students bring with it all of the challenges and problems and difficulties that come with that. So, Regent Larson.
Yes. Thank you. It's not turning on.
There you go.
Is it on? Okay. I just wanted to kind of bring the student perspective. Something that was really interesting was that the student association, so your all student body presidents, back in July. That was the very first meeting that they all met together, and they decided in one meeting that this was the topic that they wanted to really focus on for the entire year. They had been student body presidents for 2 months, maybe, at that point, and this was the topic. 2 months later, or 3 months later, with the tragedy that happened at the U, it doesn't just affect the students on your campus or when the tragedy is on your front door. It really did affect the entire system. You had students all across the state, not even part of the system, even from our private institutions, that felt this. Because a student issue at one institution is not just theirs, it's the whole system. And so they really do recognize the energy and the effort that all of you presidents and us as a system really are focusing on campus safety. We know that it's a sacrifice, and we know that it's a lot of energy and money, and it's a lot of prioritization, but campus safety for the health of the system is so incredibly important to our students, and that's not going away anytime soon. So the focus and the more conversations you can all have together, because like I said, if it's happening at one institution, it's happening in some sort of effect at another institution. So that conversation with all of you together and this type of dialogue, finding resources and hearing what other campuses are doing is important, and I'd encourage all of you to keep your students and your student body presence very informed, and transparency matters. Your students see that transparency effort that you put in.
Thank you very much, Regent Larson. I'll turn it back to Chair Simmons.
Well, thank you very much for the thoughtful discussion. It really is our, you know, we can talk a lot about priorities, but all of us who are parents and those who are students, we all know that this is the number one priority we must have, and keeping students not only informed but engaged in creating solutions, I think, is really critically important. So thank you for the good work that's being done. We appreciate President Watkins, especially the many hours I've known as a member of the R&R team. We've had discussions about this over the last year. This has really been an all hands on deck kind of campus wide effort to really up the game, and I've greatly appreciated, as everybody else has, the transparency that you referred to and the commitment to getting it right. And there is, I think, a lot that we can learn from each other, and I'm pleased to hear that a lot of that's going on. So we thank you. We're going to now adjourn to our committee meetings, which are going to be held in the new Graham Science Center. We're all looking forward to seeing this great new facility.
Glad to have you over there.
And we'll start those meetings here in 15 minutes.
If you just walk towards the library, it's the building on the right. You'll see it. So
thank you.
It's right next door. Thanks.
We're on the move.
Follow the crowd. I just looked through the window and I saw it. What is this?
time.